This week on Texas Scorecard Radio in the news, we get the electoral lay of the land across the state, talk about an election down in South Texas thrown out for charges of voter fraud, and we'll hear about how conservative groups are gearing up for the upcoming legislative session. In our interview, we talked to Dr. Steve Croft, a neurologist from Houston, about brain death, what it is, what it isn't, and the public policy and medical ethics consequences. And finally, we'll close with a commentary from Carrie Cheshire, last in a four-part series about the Texas House Speaker's race. Broadcasting from the 1836 studios, this is Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald. You can find me on Twitter at TweetTonyMac. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And you can find us on the web, www.texasscorecard.com. To get started with this week's news, I've got Brandon Waltons with the Texas Scorecard Capital Bureau in. Wanted to get a little bit of a lay of the land about how things are shaping up for the November elections. Very different circumstances out there if you're a Texas state senator versus being a Texas state representative running for re-election this cycle.
That's exactly right. Now, we've got just a few weeks until the election day, November 6th, and we're seeing a lot of races heat up, but you're seeing a big difference, as you said, between the Texas House races, where these Republicans, mostly incumbents, are running in those seats, versus their colleagues over in the other chamber in the Senate, who are not having as difficult of a time campaigning.
Now, to be clear, whenever we look at elections in Texas, typically most districts not very competitive in November, but you've got the Democrats saying, oh man, this is an opportunity, this is a blue wave, our people are excited, they really don't like the president, yes. And we want to go out and vote against Republicans, and you're seeing some opportunity for the Democrats on the House side, but on the Senate side, it feels like the Republicans are really kind of taking care of business.
No, that's exactly right. Now, you have a couple races, Senator Don Huff, and Senator Connie Burton, who are running competitive races, but they seem to be doing well. They're raising more money. But over in the House, I mean, you have, depends on who's counting, anywhere from 5 to 15 and maybe more seats that Democrats think are in play, that they think they can win.
All over the state. So you've got these two seats up in the Metroplex, Don Huff, and Connie Burton. They're doing a good job in their reelection campaigns. You actually have a seat down in South Texas, Pete Flores, flip from the Democrats to the Republicans. The senators are doing well. These House members, not so well. What's the difference there? Why is that?
Well, you know, the answer lies largely in how the chambers performed last session. So you'll remember that while the Senate was busy passing conservative reforms, you know, property tax reform, you know, serious ethics reform, the House was largely stalling all this.
And yeah, was not killing these things, right?
Under the leadership of Speaker Joe Strauss. And so now that's kind of coming home to roost, because you've got senators that are able to go tell their constituents and go tell voters that I voted for this, I did X, I did Y.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in the House, your average Republican doesn't have a lot to campaign on.
Well, it was really very clear the special session that happened last summer. You had the governor call a special session. He says, look, we have 20 bills that I want to pass. But these are conservative things, property tax reform, pro-life things, stuff that like resonate with voters.
Right.
And he puts these things on the agenda, and the Senate passes 18 of the 20 quickly.
Yes.
And then in the House, you know, they run out the clock.
Exactly. And only pass, you know, ultimately a handful of them. You know, grassroots, you know, really going to have to work extra hard, especially in some of these competitive races for our conservative folks on the ballot.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, and we'll know what is responsible when we see what the results are in November. Thanks for your reporting on it, Brandon.
Thank you.
Now let's turn and talk to Miriam Cepeda with the Rio Grande Valley Bureau for Texas Scorecard. Big story down there in the Valley, a Mission mayoral election being thrown out. The longtime incumbent sued and said, hey, this election was tainted by voter fraud, and a judge agreed. You sat in on that election. Tell us a little bit about what you found out.
Yes. Hi, Tony. Yes, it was about a two-week trial between former mayor of 20 years, Norberto Beto Salinas, and current mayor, Armando Doc Ocaña, and he was also a former City of Mission council member. And so what happened was, in the June 9th runoff election, The city was stunned that Beto Salinas lost by 157 votes to Armando da Ocaña. And the people were stunned because in May, Beto Salinas only lost by 3 votes. So initially, Salinas accepted defeat, but it wasn't until people came out and said that they were bribed and that their mail ballot was harvested. So his son, attorney Rick Salinas, filed a petition in July claiming bribery, illegal voting, and mail ballot harvesting occurred during the June 9th runoff election, which, mind you, normally runoff elections don't get more voters during the election. And they had 600 more voters come out and vote.
And so let's talk a little bit about what some of these allegations were that came out in the trial. I mean, you had allegations of bribery. I think there was something about somebody being paid with sacks of clothes. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, one, she was promised a bag of clothes. Unfortunately, it wasn't confirmed if she ever received it, and I don't think she did. Other people, convicted felons and some drug addicts testified that they were paid $10 to $40 to vote.
Wow.
And they would get their family involved as well.
Interesting thing here, the head of the Texas Democratic Party involved on the side of the guy accused of voter fraud.
Yes. Texas Democratic Chairman Gilberto Hinojosa represented Ocaña, and it was very interesting to see his demeanor throughout the whole trial, because, mind you, we have Democrats saying that there is no illegal voting, there is no election fraud that's occurring, and yet every time a witness would testify that they were bribed, he would object, and he at times, even with the expert witness, attorney George Corville, he was badgering the witness, saying he was unqualified to testify.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you being there and reporting on that, and thanks for your coverage of really a very big story.
Yes, thank you, Tony.
Now turning our focus to the Texas Capitol, let's talk with Sal Ayala of Empower Texans, coalition of conservative groups calling for some big reforms in the upcoming session.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. So this group of 18 organizations who are calling themselves a conservative Texas budget coalition had a press conference the other day where they announced their top priorities for the coming legislative session. And those priorities include such things as passing a conservative Texas budget, implementing conservative spending limits, enacting local property tax relief, abolishing the business margins tax, and finally a couple of measures related specifically to the budget and budgeting process. It's adopting a tax relief fund and also securing budget transparency and accountability by enacting program-based budgeting and zero-based budgeting.
Yeah, you know, this is something interesting over the last couple of sessions. You've seen these groups kind of unite and say, hey, we want a budget that is going to be fairly static, you know, population plus inflation. We don't want it to grow too fast. But then there's also been a focus to say, hey, how can we actually improve things in Texas government where, it's a little more transparent, it's a little more open of a process, and we're not just assuming, hey, because we spent that dollar the year before, we got to spend it again the next year.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that point up, Tony, because I think the zero-based part of this is kind of the one that's overlooked the most easily. One of the problems I have with our budgeting process is it assumes that the amount that we're spending is legitimate. And what zero-based budgeting does is it forces all these agencies to come in and talk about the programs that they want support for and to justify those programs, starting with a zero baseline and justifying all of their spending.
Yeah, a lot of good focus as well on property tax reform. That's something that's affecting, pretty much every Texan in one way or another. If they don't pay it directly, they pay it indirectly. Huge property tax bills. What are they calling for in terms of reform?
Right. So the coalition is actually, as part of their plan, they're mirroring what the governor is calling for in limiting the growth of local property taxes by 2.5%. Now, it's not entirely accurate to say limiting, because what it actually does is it empowers taxpayers at the ballot box to vote for or against those tax increases when they're over 2.5%.
Yeah. And so if they wanted to increase taxes, they just got to sell it to the voters. Right.
That's right.
I appreciate your reporting on it, Sal.
Okay. Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's my pleasure to welcome on the program this week Dr. Steve Croft, a neurologist from Houston. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
You know, Dr. Croft, I wanted to talk about an issue, the issue of brain death. There's been certain stories in the news recently about how Texas handles these situations where patients are dying or appear to be dying or we think are dead. And a lot of times it comes down to this saying of, oh, well, they're brain dead. You know, their body is functioning, but they're brain dead. And there's certain implications of that. And I realized as I was seeing these stories, you know, I don't really, as a non-doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm not a doctor. I don't know anything about what does this really mean? And so I reached out and I got connected with you, and I just wanted to hear from an expert, what is brain death?
Well, I'm happy to try to explain. First, let's talk about the definition of death. It, actually, in Texas, as in, I believe, every state, death is defined two ways. One is the total cessation of circulation and respiration, that is breathing. In other words, your heart stops, you stop breathing, and it's irreversible. You're considered dead. But there's also another definition, and that is the total cessation of brain activity, including the brainstem, and something to the effect as described by current medical standards. And the reason that brain death actually came about goes back to organ transplantation. When we started thinking about transplanting organs in the late 60s, a difficulty came up whereby how can you take out someone's heart if that person is still alive?
Right.
So the Neurological Society got together, and actually it came from Harvard, and they defined what constitutes brain death. In other words, someone who the likelihood of recovery is nil, even though that they are on a respirator and, you know, their heart is still beating. And so that's how brain death came into existence. And really, the only reason that I can think of that you must do a brain death exam is when you are thinking about doing transplantation and you have a potential organ donor. So let me explain how the diagnosis of brain death is made.
Yeah, that would be real helpful.
Yeah, but so first off, you have to have what's known as an irreversible coma of known cause. Coma is defined as a total lack of responsiveness. In other words, a lack of purposeful movement, lack of response to pain. So that's the first thing.
Sure.
And then the coma has to be due to a known cause. For example, trauma, brain tumor, hemorrhage, stroke, those are, or prolonged deprivation of oxygen. Those are by far the most common causes, and, you know, we look for that. Now, there are also exclusions. For example, the person has to be at a normal temperature. You know, we hear about people who are in near drowning events where, you know, they're submerged under cold water for what seems like a long period of time, but yet they make a full recovery.
And diabetics, so you hear of certain situations come up where, you know, there'll be a coma.
Yeah. Exactly. Someone who has a extremely high blood sugar, or someone who has a very low sodium level, they will be in a deep coma, perhaps, but that sort of coma is reversible. So we look at the labs to make sure the blood sugar is okay, the electrolytes are okay, and also that certain drugs aren't on board. For example, phenobarbital or any barbiturate or other sedating medication, which could explain a lack of responsiveness. So, and by the way, these criteria... Now, I treat adults only, so I'm only familiar with the adult criteria, but these criteria came from the American Academy of Neurology. And I think that a lot of the controversy that comes up occurs when these criteria are not followed. So one of the criteria, again, it's the presence of a irreversible coma. Second is that you have to have a lack of brainstem reflexes, such as response of the pupils to light, the gag reflex where you stick, you know, like a Q-tip down into the person's mouth to see if it elicits a gag reflex, because that's a very strong reflex, and, you know, its absence really indicates severe injury to the brainstem.
So, you know, I think a lot of people have a concern about this. We hear stories of, you know, and they're rare, but we hear stories of people who are in a coma, you know, for 10 years, you know, in a coma, and then they awaken from this coma. So clearly these people were not dead, you know, they are not dead, but they are in a state of inactivity. How do we tell the difference between these things, and is there a reliable difference?
Well, that's exactly right, that if a person is in a, say, a coma, or there's also a syndrome known as persistent vegetative state, they may not be very active, and they may not have much going on, but they may have some of these brainstem reflexes that I'm talking about, like their pupils are reactive to light, or they do have a gag reflex. Or, you know, another criteria is breathing. They may be able to actually breathe on their own. And this is a totally different situation from brain death. And it's my understanding that they've looked at studies of people who meet the actual criteria for brain death, you know, the coma, the lack of brainstem reflexes, apnea test, which is where we actually oxygenate the person and then take them off of the respirator for a period of time to look at their drive to breathe. And if a person meets all of these criteria, and actually the exam should be repeated after a period of time, for example, 6 hours, if someone meets all of these criteria, it's my understanding that there's never been anyone who has come back. In other words, the people who you hear about and read about, they are not... they're not meeting the criteria for brain death.
So I've heard people argue before, to try and argue and say, well, the brain death isn't a thing. But I think what I'm hearing from you is there is definitely this thing, brain death, where there is no brain activity. There is no ability to have a recovery, even though the body is capable of being maintained on machines. But that may be something that is misunderstood or possibly misdiagnosed from time to time.
That's right. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from, you know, people asking about EEG, you know, is the EEG flat? Does that mean they're brain dead? If you notice, I haven't mentioned EEG up to this point, because actually EEG is not one of the necessary components to diagnose brain death, and the presence of a so-called flat EEG alone does not mean that someone's brain dead. So I think it's very important for whoever is making the diagnosis of brain death that they really are, you know, trained and qualified and aware of the criteria, because it is, as you can imagine, it's critically important to know And, you know, when you're talking to a family, whether or not their loved one actually is brain dead or not.
So, you know, I know that these situations come up here in Texas. There's a controversial law here in Texas, the Texas Advanced Directive Act, which puts certain authority and vests certain authority with medical professionals, with hospitals, to decide to essentially pull the plug on a patient who is seen as not recoverable. And you have families who are in situations like this who say, no, we have hope that this person will recover. What's going on there? Is this a misconception on the part of the family, on the part of the medical professionals, maybe both, about what is possible with patients?
I think that these sort of situations occur when there's not good communication between the family members and the physician. Because someone with an advanced directive has indicated their wishes about what should happen in a certain situation, they don't wish to have life support, and, you know, there are situations where someone collapses outside of the hospital and they're put on life support, and then the question comes up, well, should we continue this life support? And, you know, I've found in my experience that these situations require very, close and discussions with the family and understanding, their grief and their shock at the situation. And I think that the family needs to be approached in a way that the doctor just doesn't come out and say, look, you know, your loved one signed this advanced directive and there's no hope, we're taking them off the ventilator. The situation needs to be explained to the next of kin. And hopefully, I would encourage anyone who, is thinking about signing an advance directive to let their family know that they're doing this and to discuss the situation with their family. In many years that I've been in practice, over 20 years, I only remember one situation where the family had great difficulty accepting the fact that their loved one was unfortunately not going to make it, or at best, going to come back to a, situation that was already not good.
Right. Yeah. So what are the medical ethics side of it? I mean, is it appropriate? Are there situations where it's appropriate to withdraw the life support prior to an actual finding of brain death?
The answer to that is yes. In fact, brain death does not necessarily need to be diagnosed to withdraw life support. Someone, say, who has metastatic cancer or advanced Alzheimer's disease, who, for one reason or another, they do end up on a ventilator in the intensive care unit when clearly that person did not, that wasn't their wishes. And, I think about this, or one way to think about this is the ventilator and all of the interventions in the ICU are really standing in the way and prolonging the inevitable. And, What I do strongly feel is that this is a decision that the patient should make, or at least the patient's next of kin, and hopefully that they've, appointed someone with that power to make decisions for them. And so, yes, it is ethical to, terminate life support if the patient or the family member expresses those wishes, and other criteria are met, of course, that it is a terminal illness and, that you're only prolonging the moment of death. But on the other hand, it is a decision that, should not be imposed in my opinion, on the family.
Yeah, and that's one of those issues that is, percolating through the legislature, and that there's certain policy implications our friends at Texas Right to Life and others are working on these issues. Well, I think we're running out of time. Tell listeners, where can they get in touch with you, learn more about your practice if they want to reach you? Where do they go?
Sure. I have a website, www.drcroft, that's spelled out Dr. DrCroft.com. And my office is in Houston, Texas. They can look me up, and I'd be happy, to speak with them or see them.
Thank you, Dr. Croft, for joining us. Thank you for sharing some of your expertise on this really a delicate subject, and one that I think listeners need to understand a little more before they make decisions at the ballot box and talking to their legislators and those sorts of things. So thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Have you heard about the Texas Torchbearers Program? It's a program that makes activism fun and exciting. You can sign up at TexasTorchbearers.com. There, you can learn about the easiest and most effective ways to engage your government officials in order to hold them accountable. As a Texas Torchbearer, you can earn cool prizes like an awesome pair of custom-fit cowboy boots with the Texas Torchbearer logo on it. As a promo, we gave away a beautiful custom-engraved Glock handgun. Sign up today at TexasTorchbearers.com. That's TexasTorchbearers with an S.com.
Up next in this week's commentary, Carrie Cheshire brings us the last segment in a four-part series on the criteria that Texans should be looking at in picking the next speaker of the Texas House.
Every lawmaker, every organization, and every citizen have issues that are important to them. Now is the time to be asking speaker candidates what will happen with those issues next session. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Carrie Cheshire. Earlier this month, we began laying out a few factors citizens and their representatives should use to judge candidates seeking election as the next Texas House Speaker. Our third requirement is that a speaker candidate must make a public, on-the-record pledge to bring specific conservative reforms to the House floor for a debate and vote. Candidates can make all kinds of pledges about having a member-driven House, altering the makeups of committees, and amending the rule. Those are good things, to be sure. But what matters most to real Texans are legislative results. Indeed, it doesn't make a difference to Texans if the property tax bill is House Bill 2 or Senate Bill 1100, if it has one author or several, or if it goes through the Ways and Means Committee instead of State Affairs. What makes a difference to Texans is if the bill makes it to the floor for an up or down vote, where it can pass or fail, and every vote can be held accountable. What issues should speaker candidates commit to bringing to the floor? Well, that's up to the people. Every lawmaker, every organization, and every citizen have issues that are important to them. The Texas GOP has its legislative priorities and ballot propositions. We at Texans for Fiscal Responsibility have our own priorities, and candidates have a lot of choices to choose from and pick and choose those issues that are most important to them. While a speaker has only one vote and thus shouldn't pledge that something will ultimately pass the Texas House, he can definitely ensure that the process works so that particular bills have a chance to be considered by the body as a whole. From our perspective, any good candidate should pledge that legislation to strengthen the state spending limit, repeal the Robin Hood property tax, cap other property tax increases, and provide you for uniform election dates make it to the floor for an up or down vote. But those are just our top priorities. Citizens and lawmakers supporting constitutional carry, pro-life reforms, or other matters should seek similar commitments on their own. After all, lawmakers can only be held accountable by the promises that they make. Right now, citizens and lawmakers alike are at the height of their leverage and capable of extracting clear commitments from Texas House Speaker hopefuls, if they ask for them. They should use that leverage to their advantage and ensure that reforms most important to Texans have a clear runway next session. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Carrie Cheshire.
If you missed any of Carrie's commentaries, you can find those by going and subscribing to the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, available on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. Thanks for listening, and go do great things for Texas.
Texas Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.